This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Shug McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, the show trainers listen to. Our guest this week trains in Southern California at Santa Anita and runs horses at every thoroughbred venue in the state. To date, his charges have won 348 races, with 1,087 of them in the money, while banking over $7 million in purses. I am pleased to have Matthew Chu for the hour. Hi, Matt. How's it going?
Oh, real good, Jude. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. You deserve some kind of award. You trained for my brother, Mark, and having been one of Mark's trainers, I know that's not an easy task. He's a brilliant guy, but not the easiest client that I've ever had.
Well, I think he's actually mellowing with age, Jude. He's been, you know, very easy to work with the last couple of years. So,
well,
you know, time has a way of mellowing just about everybody.
That's true, and he speaks highly of you. He enjoys your relationship, and it's like we often talk about on this show. Picking a trainer is a lot like picking a girlfriend or a cigar. There's one for everybody, and you have to have that rapport and that common goal to accomplish. And Mark enjoys claiming horses with you and developing horses with you, and so it's a really good relationship that you guys have.
Well, it's a win-win because Mark, obviously, as you know, does a lot of his own research, and he finds little nuggets that you know, that I obviously overlook and don't have the time to actually dive into some of these horses that he's picked out. And he's made some, you know, very astute claims that we've been the only one in on them. So it definitely is a good team so far.
Yeah, he certainly does his homework. Well, you're a third-generation horseman, and I, as I was doing my research for the show, I came across a UPI obituary for your grandfather, William H. Chu, and oddly enough, it was in the Norwalk, Connecticut newspaper called The Hour, and it said that your grandfather was a horse trainer and racer. Tell me about him.
Well, he was quite a character. He kind of liked him back to the old-time horsemen, where he would get a couple horses together and he'd get a stable rolling, and he would when he was on a roll, he was on a roll. He was one of those guys that when it was all going good, he was buying the cars and buying the furniture and, you know, and living the life. And when things went a little south, they were repossessing the car and repossessing the furniture, and he'd start all over again. But he was a very very likable individual and a very good horseman. He just was, you know, he just liked to live life on a little bit more on the edge than most of us are comfortable with.
Well, it seemed to me that he must have been a rather important guy, because he was at Del Mar and San Diego area, and the obituary showed up all the way in Connecticut, and so I figured he must have been a figure of somewhat national prominence.
Well, he raced all over, and you know, he didn't let much grass grow under his feet, you know, from what I understood. I obviously didn't, you know him till, you know, later on in years when he'd already retired and such. But my father said he, you know, they were quite mobile, and you know, they moved around the country quite a bit, and he had a very, you know, very interesting life, but he was very hands-on horseman, as, you know, that generation was, and taught my dad, obviously, an awful lot.
Yeah, now your father, Richard, he was born in New York, and I read that he was a jockey when he was 18 in Canada.
Yeah, he rode races in Canada. He also, rode races down here in Southern California and Northern California. He was all over. he always struggled with his weight. So, you know, his career wasn't very long. You know, I've got a lot of wind pictures, and you know, from a short period of time that he did ride, and he looks like, you know, he looks like a praying mantis on the horses. He was just a little bit too big for, you know, to make the weight comfortably. So he rode for a couple of years, and then after he finished his riding career, got too big for it. He joined the Marine Corps for a while.
Yeah, I read that he went to Korea in the Marine Corps, and when he came back, he trained horses for nearly 50 years. That's a heck of a career. He was a fixture on the Southern California circuit, and I was reading some of the stakes winners he had. Hasty Trip was a favorite of mine when I was a kid. T-Ax won the California Oaks, and then Lulu Torch. That was a name that really struck a chord with me. Lulu Torch, she was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, most of his big horses were back when I was very young, but he did have quite a role for a number of years, and you know, he was a complete horseman. He knew him from the ground up. He knew how to muck a stall. He knew how to gallop horses. He galloped a lot of his own horses, shoot clear up into his, in mid-40s. And, you know, he really enjoyed being around the animals. He had a way with them where you could just tell he communicated with them, on a one-to-one basis. He communicated with horses much better than he communicated with people.
Did he work for your grandfather? Is that how he got his start?
Yeah, he rubbed horses for him, and you know, muck stalls, galloped horses for him. Yes, that's how he traveled the circuit with him. So
and of course you worked for your dad in turn, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I started out. I was probably 10 years old, and I thought one of the biggest days of my life was when they finally let me rub the pony. And started with him one Del Mar rubbing the pony, and obviously as I got a little older, I worked through high school. I was doing work experience in the morning, so I'd actually come in and rub horses in the morning. I'd go to school in the afternoon, and then once I finished with my high schooling down here, my father moved to Northern California, and I followed him up there, and that's where I worked for him for a few years, and then I went out on my own shortly after.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that rubbing the pony is a big rite of passage in our sport.
Yeah.
And I always tell people about Aaron Wellman, who is the master of Eclipse Thoroughbreds, and how he used to be sitting on my front porch door at Del Mar to go to the barn with me when he was like 5 or 6 years old, and he got to rub the pony one summer, and you would have thought he was taking care of Secretariat. I mean, he used to do that pony up in fours. The pony never looked better.
Oh, God.
But it's a big deal when you're a kid, you know?
Oh, for them to trust you to put your first set of bandages on? I mean, my God, that was, like you say, a big rite of passage. And it's funny you should mention Aaron Wellman. Mike and Corey Wellman were actually my father was actually their first trainer.
Wow, that's a cool connection. Well, they've had horses for many, many years and have done quite well breeding and racing. So, they're a great racing family as well. Well, your dad, you know, I read a quote of his, and you can tell me whether it's accurate. Not everything you read on the web is accurate, but he said, if you're not at Santa Anita, you're camping out. And I kind of agree with that philosophy. Did he really say that?
Oh, he said it, and he believed it wholeheartedly. He absolutely loved Santa Anita, and who wouldn't? I mean, if you're going to train horses, this really is an amazing place to be. You've got the San Gabriels as a background. You've got the nice weather. You've got the prestigious racing, the good horses. And especially back in his day, you had an amazing group of trainers that, really defined the sport in that era.
Well, it is an amazing place, and the mornings. Talk about the mornings at Santa Anita and how special they are. As I travel around the country, I go to a lot of racetracks broadcasting the races on the radio, and there's nothing like a Santa Anita morning, in my opinion.
Well, Jude, you know, every I mean, it sounds pretty cliche, but every time every morning I wake up, I thoroughly enjoy coming to the barn because, and in part because of the atmosphere here at Santa Anita. You've got, these sunrises, which are absolutely spectacular. You've got the nice weather. You've got the mountains in the background. You've got a grandstand that when you look at it, and I've been looking at it my entire life, I never get tired of looking at the old Art Deco, architecture and, the history that's here. And you feel it when you walk through the gates. And I think for anybody that's hasn't spent a morning at Santa Anita, they truly need to indulge themselves and come out to Clocker's Corner and have breakfast, watch the horses train, and believe me, you'll feel like you're part of the show.
Yeah, it's almost a religious experience. I think it's kind of an awe before the sacred thing. If you're into racing and you realize all the great horses that have run down that stretch at Santa Anita, I mean, that's really truly the great race place, and so many champions have run there and some amazing races, and then the sunrise and the whole atmosphere, and usually there's Hall of Fame trainers holding court and owners excited about their horses, and it's just an experience that you can't really describe. There's no words for it. And every morning when I would walk out at the first set, I would think of that passage in the Bible. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And you cannot help but have an emotional response to that beauty that is Santa Anita.
Well, it's not a bad office, let me tell you.
It's fantastic. Well, your dad... Also started a few jockeys in his day, but you have a special relationship with Craig McGurn, and talk about Craig and him working for your dad.
poor Craig. He was he started out, rubbing horses for my dad and galloping horses, and my dad has brought a couple of young riders up, one of which was Rudy Rosales also, but with Craig in particular, he made him really go through, go through the ringer. He was one of the. My father was, an old time. You're going to do it the hard way. There are no easy ways to, a path worth taking. And Craig would show up in the morning. He would constantly be carrying his stick. If you mucked a stall, he was carrying a stick. If you went to the grocery store, he was carrying his stick. He was never to be without his whip. I remember one time they were riding out to the racetrack and, Craig had reached up and grabbed hold of the martingale, and my dad reached over with the pony reins and just smacked him over the top of the hands. You don't grab hold of the martingale. If you're going to grab hold of the horse, you grab hold of his mane, or you take hold of the reins. He had him jogging religiously. They would sit in the tack room and my dad would hit a stopwatch and would, command Craig to be within a fifth of a second when he'd stop the watch to try and build his clock. And, through it all, Craig ended up developing into a very useful rider. But he paid his dues.
Well, I tell you, that horsemanship sure paid off one day at Del Mar. And I don't know if you were there to see it or not, but he was on a horse for John Valpredo, and the horse ran off the wrong way with Craig on him, and the starting gate was already in place. And Craig somehow slid that horse through the gate, and I wouldn't have given 3 cents for his chances of doing that, but he did it. And it was one of the most amazing things I had ever seen in my life. I mean, how crazy the crowd is at Del Mar, and all of a sudden everybody's just silent, and they're watching this, and a lot of people were thinking he was going to bail off. I mean, I would have thought he would have bailed off. He shot that horse through the gate the wrong way, and I don't even think the gate crew realized what the heck happened, but it was one of the most amazing exhibitions of riding that I had ever seen, and I kind of laugh about it now because we're following Craig on Facebook and stuff. You see he's doing rodeos and stuff. He obviously hasn't wised up.
Yeah, well, hard to get it completely out of your system, that's for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you have the family connection and all to racing, but what really got you hooked on the sport?
Yeah, Jude, I really never envisioned another path. I had some opportunities growing up. I was very active as a photographer. I've offered a full scholarship, you know, for my photography, and I could have gone that direction, but it never, you know, it never really seemed like, you know, I never looked at it as being a choice. I always knew what I wanted to become, and that was a trainer like my father. And, you know, I had blinkers on the entire time. I never looked around for anything else. So it was just a natural fit. You know, I knew my father was a good horseman. I learned, you know, from the ground up from him, and I've always had a feel for the horses. I've always liked being around the horses. I couldn't imagine really doing anything else.
You only worked for your father before you went out on your own?
I worked for him. I only worked for one other trainer for a short period of time, and that was a gentleman by the name of Roy Waugh. They were stabled behind us at Golden Gate while I was still rubbing horses for my father, and he was going to ship a string of horses from Golden Gate to Delaware Park, and he said if I go to work for him for the summer, he'd send me to England, Ireland, and France to pick up horses for him. So, you know, I jumped at the opportunity to, you know, see a little different part of the country, and then obviously go over to Europe on a couple of trips to import horses back for him. That's going back quite a ways. That was when Summa Stables was quite active, and that's who he was training for.
Bruce McNall, I remember that when they were going to send some horses to Delaware, and they actually did. I think they won a few races over there too.
We won our first 11 out of 15.
Yeah.
Over there.
That's all right. That's a good meet.
It was absolutely nuts. We couldn't do anything wrong. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, if you just tuned in, this is Jude Feld, and you're listening to the California-based trainer Matt Chu on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasic Tipton. We thank you for listening. Matt, you've been training horses since 1982 on your own, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And what did you learn from your dad that you carry over to this very day?
Patience and pay attention to what your horse is trying to tell you. And I think especially in this day and age, it's more important than ever because, back when he was training, you know, there wasn't a lot of information available to the owners. So, you know, basically a trainer would be able to walk through his barn, kind of see what his horses are telling him, and then react and do what is necessary by the horses, on a day-to-day basis. And now there's so much information out there that you get a lot of people trying to tell you what to do, and you need to really stick by your guns and just do right by the horse. If you do right by the horse, then everybody wins. And that's one of the lessons I try and adhere to, because it doesn't change. The horses, horses don't own calendars. They don't have agendas. You know, they are what they are. When you go into the barn every morning and a horse is feeling good, he's feeling good. And if he's ready to do something, he's ready to do something. If he's not, he's not. And, so I try not to put them on human schedules. I try and put them on their own schedule.
Yeah, you're noted for developing a program for each specific horse. And a lot of trainers say that they do that, but some of the bigger outfits, they're kind of forced into a mold of we got to get these horses out. You know, it's a time factor when you're training a whole bunch of horses, and you can't maybe do some of the things that a trainer with a small barn like yourself can do. You can mess with a horse's head a little bit. You can give him a little extra walk. You can take him through the paddock. You have the luxury of time, which a lot of other trainers don't have.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, for the rare individual, I think that it makes a big difference. I do watch a lot of these assembly line type operations that are highly successful and do quite well year after year. But, you know, I have to believe that there's, you know, horses that do slip through the cracks, that just a few minutes here or something done a little different there would make a difference. And so we try to apply that. You know, the most horses I've ever had at any one time was 25. And, you know, that's about maxes me out as far as being able to be hands-on with them every day. I mean, I try and touch every horse every day. We have a scale in the barn. We actually bring them up, weigh them, inspect the horses, and then we'll jog them down the road just to, you know, just to see where they're at on a day-to-day basis. And I believe that's important. In the larger barns, obviously, they don't have the time to do that, but you can't argue their success rate. There's a lot of guys here, Jerry Hollendorfer in particular, that is extremely successful, and, you know, he's training 100 head of horses.
Yeah, you're also very proactive in social media, and you have a camera at your barn where the owners can watch their horses during the day. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I found that to be a benefit for my clients and myself. We set up cameras going back about almost 10 years now, and it you know, especially for the out of town owners that don't get a chance to ever see their horses, they can peek in on them, you know, via the web now, and you know, at least feel like they're part of the, you know, part of what's going on. And the other thing it does, it really shows the people how much work goes into these horses. A lot of my clients were, you know, astounded to see the amount of people wandering back and forth through the barn in the morning and how much work actually does go into the, you know, training of these horses on a day-to-day basis. It's very labor intensive. And I don't think a lot of people really appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I think most people think trainers get up in the morning, go have coffee out at Clocker's Corner, shoot the breeze with their friends, you know, go back, make sure that everybody's okay, and hit the road to the golf course. I think that's the that's the concept that I think a lot of people have, my ex-wife being one of them. but it's a lot different than that. I can tell you, and I know you know, that there's a lot of things, even in a small stable, that go on during the day. Richard Mandela, we talked to him before the Breeders' Cup, and one thing that cracked me up that he said was, when you get to the barn in the morning, you know there's going to be something wrong. There's not always something right, but there's always something wrong. So, you know, it's kind of that shroud that hangs over a trainer every morning when you get there, the words every trainer dreads: boss, come and look at this horse, you know. And it's a constant struggle, but there is a lot involved, and I think that's a great idea to show absentee owners exactly what they're paying for when they send that check every month.
Yeah, because, you know, it does cost a lot of money to keep a horse in training, and, you know, unless you actually see it for yourself, it's hard to appreciate it. And what Richard said is true. There's usually an issue, and one thing about training horses where the mindset can kind of get you a little screwed up is it's really my job to look for the things that are not right. And I'm always looking for what's wrong. And, you know, it becomes a little bit of a, you have to be careful not to get a negative mindset over that, because, and especially not carry it home to your wife. but that is our job. Yeah. We're looking for the problem or potential problem. There'll be 1,000 things that are going on that are absolutely perfect around you, but you need to find that one, you know, the one thing that's not quite right. That's your job.
So. Yeah, I think that's a good point. You do get to the point where you think there's something wrong with every horse sometimes, and it's mm-hmm. not the case. And you do have to safeguard yourself against that. But, you know, it's so rewarding when a horse turns the corner, or when you do figure it out, when you get something right with a horse, it just makes you smile inside.
Oh, absolutely. There's no better feeling than, you know, seeing a horse just respond to what you're doing and where you figured something out. You know, it's like, you know, you're putting a puzzle together and you finally find the pit, you know, the one piece that wasn't working, and you get it to fit, and the horse turns around. And whether it's just a simple gallop in the morning or whether it translates into a, you know, race and, you know, a win in the afternoon, it's a very rewarding feeling, because that's, at the end of the day, that's kind of what we're here for, is to try and, you know, do the best by our horses and figure them out. And that's where the real joy comes in, is to watch a horse actually flourish under your care. And And there's nothing more that, you know, and there's nothing worse than watching a horse, you know, go south on you and you can't figure it out. That's what keeps you up at night. Is you, you know, you'll, there's always going to be the horse that, you know, no matter what you try, you just don't seem to be have a feel for them. And that's what keeps a lot of trainers up at night, because, you know, one thing about most trainers, they're not quitters. They're going to try and figure it out, even if it drives them crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's those little subtle things, and a lot, you know, when you get a new horse in the barn, when you claim a horse, you can't wait till the next morning. It's like Christmas. You take the bandages off. You see what you got. You jog them down the road, as you mentioned, and that type of thing. And sometimes you have an idea in your head of what the horse might become. Maybe you want to switch them to the grass, or you want to change distances or riders or whatever it is. But talk about that for a second, and what you go through with a claiming horse.
Well, you know, usually when there's a couple different types of, you know, claims or ways to approach claiming. One is you'll see a horse running in the afternoon that looks like whatever he's doing is not the right fit for them. If he's sprinting and you feel like the horse wants to go two turns, you might zero in on, you know, that, and with the idea that you're going to claim the horse and send him to, you know, two turns. Or if he's running on the dirt and he looks like he might benefit from the grass, I like to be able to look at a horse and see something that we could potentially do different that could improve the horse. I'm not a, you know, a lot of people like to, you know, claim horses and just turn them, you know, claim them, run them back, turn them, you know, and all that. We actually try and look at, you know, horses a little more long, you know, long term, and try and figure out something that we can do a little bit different, whether it's blinkers, change of surface, change of distance, change of rider, that might help the horse go forward and actually, become a better horse. And that's one thing, you know, working for your brother has done for me, is your brother is so into his research, goes so deep that you'll find a horse that has a, you know, a big grass family, you know, a generation down, and the horse has never been tried on the turf, or the horse wants to, you know, comes from a family that wants to go a mile and a quarter, and all they've been doing is sprinting him. He has really focused me in on trying to do a bit more research and find out what the horse truly wants to do. He's not a big fan of claiming one for 10 and running it back for 10. That doesn't move the needle for him. So, you know, we attempt to do that, and obviously, you know, we've had some successes, and we have, you know, we've had some base hits and we've had some strikeouts. But it is a lot of fun. I do enjoy claiming horses. I do like, you know, trying to figure them out.
This is Jude Feld, and you're listening to Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We're going to step away for a quick break and then continue this conversation with trainer Matt Chu.
In 2015, the Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales outperformed all major North American yearling sales. The July sale, held in Lexington, Kentucky, is annually a top-ranked yearling sale by percentage of graded stakes winning graduates, and saw 15 sires represented by their highest-priced colt or filly in 2015. The prestigious Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale posted an increased average of over $322,000 while boasting a remarkably low RNA rate of just 15%, and was tremendously strong in the middle market, with a higher percentage of horses sold in the $100,000 to $300,000 range than book one of the Keeneland September sale. The New York bred sale in Saratoga produced 50 yearlings of $100,000 or higher, with an increased average of more than $81,000. The Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales, superior results. Visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York. the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They're at the top of the lane, and Elementar is now tackled by Spirit of Gion, and Spirit of Gion goes on for home. Here comes Singing Kitty on the outside. Desert Steel getting blocked on the inside. Coming with a late run, Curlin's Fox. But it is now Singing Kitty. Singing Kitty now gets the lead with 50 to go. Singing Kitty in front. And Singing Kitty and Rafael Bejarano have won the Unzip Me. Spirit of Gion had to settle for second. Curlin's Fox was third, and then Finest City.
That was Singing Kitty, one of the great Matthew Chu claims, winning a stakes race. Trevor Denman with the call, and... Matt, tell us a little bit about Singing Kitty.
Oh, she's been such a blessing, Jude. I mean, we got pointed out. She was pointed out to me as a horse that I should look at to claim by a good friend of mine, and we went over to Los Alamitos, and I took a look at her walking over and liked what I'd seen. You know, obviously liked her films prior to. The race at Los Alamitos, and so we decided to go ahead and take a shot and drop the claim for $32,000. It's just been a heck of a ride, even from the from the very start, because we actually Philly won the race for the $32,000 at Los Al. Then we found out there was another trainer in for him, Brian Corner, had actually dropped a claim in for her also, so we had to shake for her and win the shake in order to get her. And we had claimed her with the idea of trying her, trying her on the turf. So we put her in a little overnight stake at Santa Anita just to give her a turn around the track and get her used to the footing. And she handled it really well. And then we pointed her towards the California Oaks. And that was kind of the beginning of her campaign last year that she ended up winning three nice little stakes for us. And the race you played was the Unzip Me, which was by far my favorite, not because of the amount of purse money, but it was a race where, I had my friends and my family were all there, and it was quite a celebration. It was one of the highlights of my life to have my mother in the winner's circle with me and my sister and, a couple of my other very close friends at the same time. It was an amazing day. The Phillies done an awful lot for us.
Well, that's great. I'm glad we chose that clip.
Yeah.
That was a good job by Lee. It's always great when you win with your family there, and nothing like it. I mean, that's what we all get up in the morning to do, is have that moment in the winner's circle. Shane Knight used to say that you should be able to rent it and have a party in it. We work so hard to get there, and then it's like a half an hour or 30 minutes, and you're in there, 30 seconds rather, you're in there, and you should be in there for at least a half an hour, maybe longer. I mean, it's such a tough place it's the most valuable piece of real estate in the world, the winner's circle.
Yeah, you get that shot of adrenaline starting from about the quarter pole, and if your horse is in the game at the quarter pole, from the quarter pole to the wire, you know you're alive. And if you win, I mean, I don't care what, if it's a an inexpensive claimer or a, you know, horse like her, it all feels the same to me. There's no more powerful drug in the world than that that winner's circle, that's for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you do so many other things, you know, besides Claim Good Horses. You're involved with Karma, the California Retirement Management Account, which is a charitable organization that raises money for retired racehorses. Talk about your involvement with them, because I know it's something that you and your wife Candace are very close to.
Well, when I met my wife about 30 years ago, she was from the show horse. You know, one of the things that, you know, she felt like she had to do to be involved in this sport was that the horses that, you know, go through my barn needed to find, you know, proper homes when they were done racing. And she's always worked very hard at that. She's placed over 50 horses of mine, you know, in various homes. And then a spot on the board of directors opened up at Karma, and she actually was voted onto that and joined in. And, you know, that's a big cause for her. She firmly believes that if these horses are going to bring you the kind of enjoyment they bring you, and, you know, you must be responsible for them after they're done racing. And so she does everything she can to try and make sure that they get the good homes. And she really works hard. You know, as far as my part in it, you know, I assist her now and then, but she's really, you know, the driving force in this effort to, you know, rehome these horses. And she's started horse shows, which are thoroughbred only horse shows that promote, you know, to promote the thoroughbred, obviously. You know, she's very involved in the grant giving that, you know, goes to the different facilities. I think that is definitely her passion.
And well, my part of it is,
you know, occasionally helping out and then, you know, a little participation here and there, but she's actually the driving force.
Well, in the old days, you know, people would try to get horses good homes, but sometimes it didn't work out. And now it's really nice that some of these organizations have taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and really see to it that the horses have a good home. They're either repurposed or used for, you know, pleasure in some way, even if it's as a lawn ornament. Sometimes people need a horse that's in... just stands in front of their house and eats grass, and that's a great life too for a lot of these horses, and it's a great thing. Now you're involved in the horse show part of it. You actually ride in the shows, and you're a team captain of during these horse shows that
yeah.
they do.
Yeah, my wife wrangled me about 3 years ago to be in this Calcutta, which was a teams of trainers against teams of jockeys or ex-jockeys, and I'd never jumped a horse before in my life, and so she decided this would be a good idea to get a bunch of trainers that aren't too familiar with jumping and a bunch of jockeys and throw them in a ring and have them compete. I did have a little bit of an advantage. I found out ahead of time that this was going to occur, so there were teams of four. I went ahead and got Christian Mulhall, who is a show jumper by, along with a, you know, incredible horse trainer, John Sadler, which I believe he was on his way to the Olympics at one point, and then Janet Armstrong, who jumped horses up in Canada. So I went and found three of the best, strongest teammates I could find. And, we've had 3 years of, you know, competition. And so far our team is undefeated. We did have to exchange, Janet Armstrong out for Leonard Powell last year, but Leonard Powell did an amazing job, and so far we're undefeated.
So your claiming of humans is also very good.
Oh yeah, I wasn't afraid to take an edge there, because number one, I was scared to death going into that ring training, and I wanted some support. And I'll tell you what, Alan Balch doesn't help any. All he does is ridicule me the whole time I'm in there making fun of me. So, but it's all good fun. It's become a very popular event. It happens in mid-December, And it's just, it happens in the evening time at the LA Equestrian Center. And if anybody, if you have a chance to go to it, you really should. It's a lot of fun. You know, people are hooping and hollering. You see a lot of your, you know, top riders are there. Bayerano has been a great supporter. Maldonado, Pratt, they've all competed. And it's just fun to watch them do something besides running a circle.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Alan Balch, you mentioned, he's a very good rider himself. I remember when they had the Olympics at Santa Anita, he was in a pre-Olympic jumping competition there, and he did quite well. He's an amazing guy. I also heard through the grapevine that you and your wife Candace have purchased a place for retired horses for when you retire. You're all going to retire together.
Yeah, that's a, you know, we just, you know, it's obviously down the road a piece, but we had a unique opportunity to acquire a place up in Idaho, on the backside of Hayden Lake. It's about 7 miles away from Coeur d'Alene, and it's 18 acres, a beautiful piece of property. And, you know, we're renting it out now, but, you know, our goal, eventually, and who knows when this is going to happen. I mean, I don't think very many horse trainers actually retire, but, you know, if it works out, we'd like to, you know, create a facility for retired horses and then work with, kids with disabilities and challenges, and also veterans with PTSD and other ailments. I did some volunteer work in the Bay Area with kids with cerebral palsy, and it left an impression on me at the time to where if I ever had the opportunity and the means to do it, I was going to provide the same service, somewhere else. And that's really is our goal, is to have a facility that'll take care of the horses and also work with the people, and model it after the facility in Northern California. They had a program for kids with cerebral palsy, and basically, if you could afford your lessons, great. If you couldn't afford them, it was free. Racing is a very competitive business. In order for there to be winners, there has to be losers. And, you know, I've been involved in that my entire life. I really want to create an environment where when you walk on the property, everybody wins. The horses win, the people win, and, you know, just something to, you know, to do as we, you know, our twilight years. But like I say, that's a goal, and it'll happen someday, but I'm not sure when.
Yeah, well, it's down the road, obviously. You still got plenty of winners to train.
Yeah, I'm 55, so we still got some mileage left in us.
Just a kid. Well, you know, you're one of the few thoroughbred trainers with an IMDb listing, and that's quite an accomplishment. Talk a little bit about your film work and your dealings with Kenny Mayne and some of the fun stuff that you've done there.
Well, we kind of fell into it by accident. My wife works for Santa Anita, and they were at a staff meeting, and they said Burger King's going to shoot a commercial here next week, and they need a horse. My wife raises her hand and says, "We got a horse; they can use ours." And, you know, boom, we ended up filming a Burger King commercial, and then it kind of led into one thing led into another, and we got involved in we've been 50, 60 different projects throughout the years. And I was also involved in, the Seabiscuit movie, which was a huge, a huge thing for me. It was a great experience. And I worked with some of the best wranglers in, you know, Hollywood, Rusty Hendrickson being, you know, my hero. And then we also were involved in the HBO production. So it's been quite an experience. It's been, you know, we were very blessed to do it. It provided me a great education as far as, you know, seeing what horses will do outside of racing. It taught me a lot of some of the stuff I actually applied to my stable, because there's some lessons that you learn when you put horses in these different environments that do cross over quite well. But
it's important to let horses be horses sometimes.
Yeah, and it also taught me that most horses can be taught to do just about anything if you give them enough time. You know, especially in the Seabiscuit production, we had, you know, they had an unbelievable budget. So we were able to go very slow and very methodical when we were teaching the horses different routines. And, you know, if you give a horse enough time, you know, to figure it out, you know, most horses will come around. And we had a few horses that were nervous and they wouldn't settle. And they, you know, whatever we do just didn't seem to work. Well, Rusty just had us ride them around the training track until they settled. And then after a couple of days, guess what? They settled. Mm-hmm. And these, you know, when you're training, sometimes a horse will get pigeonholed as being being this or that. And people don't take the time to really try and change them or make them better. And what Rusty showed me is if you give a horse enough time, you can just about train any of the bad traits out of them. But it does take patience.
If you just tuned in, this is Jude Felden. You're listening to Matt Chu on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Phasic Tipton. Another thing that you do, you do all kinds of great things for our game. You participate in these confirmation clinics and seminars for the TOC and other people, and you also allow people to come visit your barn. You're a great ambassador for our sport. And I read somewhere that your presentation at these clinics is very professional, and you've developed quite a following on these. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the TOC, you know, was, you know, very was very good in creating these programs and, you know, and allowing the owners to come back to the barns and you know, view the horses one-on-one with the trainers. And so they asked me the one time when they were putting the program together, would you mind taking a group back there? And I did it the first time because I was horrified to speak in front of a group of people. And I figured, well, if you're ever going to get over it, this is how you start, you know? And, you know, I did my first seminar and I was sweating and nervous and not really sure what was going on. But I stumbled through it and I gave them a lot of literature and pictures and diagrams to look at. And, you know, as it went on, I started to really enjoy it. And I really have found it quite rewarding to bring people back into the barn and let them get up close, actually, you know, smell the animal, you know, get a feel for them, and then, you know, show them different things that I look for in a competitive athlete. And it has been very rewarding, and invariably I end up learning stuff, because anytime they put a clinic together, I'll go ahead and, you know, read through, you know, I've got a couple of confirmation books and just read through and get some different ideas and try and have, you know, a little different presentation than I had the time before. And it's been a win-win for, I believe, the people that attend the clinics and also for myself. And I really commend the TOC for putting those together, because they are quite valuable.
Yeah, well, for owner education, there's nothing that beats an owner that knows what's going on. And a lot of times people get in the horse business and they really don't know which end eats, as we like to say. But those are the type of things that really help other trainers with their clients, with people that get in the business, if they have a basic understanding of a horse's physiology and what a horse may have in their diet or how they're taken care of at the track, it just helps everybody down the road. And I think you should be commended for your efforts, because it's not easy to do and it is time consuming, but it's a great service, really.
Well, thank you. Like I say, it's been a win-win for on both sides, I feel. And this is kind of a funny business. You'll see a lot of people that, you know, that'll dive into it, but they really don't understand it. And I've found that those are the people that don't hang around very long. If somebody is looking to get into this industry as an owner, you know, become educated, because this is a very tough business and a lot of things happen that are unexplainable. And you need to be around it, ask questions, get a feel for it before you dive in, because otherwise, if you're not a part of what's going on, you're writing checks every week and, you know, let's face it, I mean, the average person gets beat 90% of the time, and, you know, that gets real old real quick. You need to, you know, you need to experience this to really get your, you know, full bang for your buck.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Well, you're coming off a banner year for a small stable. You had a great year in 2015, and you're off to a good start this year. I got to ask you a question, though. When I was doing my research, I came across this article about you and slow feeding. What is slow feeding?
Oh, it's actually a hay rack. It's called a slow feeder, and it's a hay rack that was designed by a friend of mine, Melissa. That the traditional hay rack, the squares are probably 8 to 10 inches in diagonal. And the squares in this slow feeder are actually about 1.5 to 2 inches in diagonal. And so what it does is it actually slows down, you know, the rate at which a horse does, you know, consume their hay rack. So it simulates grazing more than the other hay racks. The other hay racks, the problem I have with them is a horse can actually go in there and get big bites of feed. And especially when they're just coming in from the racetrack, if they're a little bit warm, they take them big bites of feed, they swallow them, they don't really chew them. I think that contributes to our colics and our compactions that we see. And the other thing I believe that the slow feeders help with is your ulcers, because the horse is, instead of eating a bunch of food and then standing in a corner for a few hours, he's nibbling away all day long. And so that naturally keeps food flowing through his gut, you know, more hours of the day, and that's a more natural way of feeding him. And I think it's a good way to help, you know, cut down on your ulcers. From an economic standpoint, there's a lot less waste. So I'm really pleased with the product.
It sounds like it's almost like a chicken wire style feeder. I mean, right?
Exactly.
I mean, little small holes as opposed. Yeah, because you see that all the time. The horse comes in, and the first thing they do is they stick their nose in that hay rack, and they pull out this big glob of hay. Looks like a feld at the dinner table. And yeah, it's crazy. Well, that's cool. I read the article, and you were very high on it, and you said even Baffert was checking you out. I thought that was a good sign.
Yeah, and he never really adopted them, but Christian Mulhall used them. You know, I know, and I'm not sure if anybody else is, but I don't see a downside to them. I like the fact that it helps to prevent those impaction colics. I mean, right there, that's gold. There's nothing worse than, you know, getting that call in this, you know, in the evening time that, you know, the horse isn't right, and I believe that our incidences of that have been cut down dramatically, you know, since I've incorporated the feeders into our program.
That's great. That's a big plus. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the long shot player's friend image of Joplin. This horse obviously reads a tow board. He hardly ever wins where he doesn't pay $30. What's the key to this guy?
I have no idea.
Good answer.
I mean, that's why he pays what he does. I mean, this horse, you know, you can't overthink it. He drives you crazy. You know, the way he trains in the morning doesn't necessarily translate to what he does in the afternoon. And, you know, some days he feels like running and other days he doesn't. When he feels like running, there's nobody that can outrun him. I mean, my God, he's been an amazing claim for us. Obviously, your brother brought this horse to me, and, you know, we claimed him for the 16,000, and we've done quite well with him, but, you know, and we've had him for quite a while, but, you know, I still don't have him figured out. I can't tell you when he's going to fire and not fire. You can't single him, and you can't throw him out, you know, when he's in the exotics.
Yeah, he's been a laugher for me. If I bet on him, he runs down the track. If I don't bet on him, he wins and pays $38, and I just he frustrates the heck out of me. So I thought maybe there was a key that I didn't know about, but I'm not going to bet on him anymore, so you're going to win lots more races with him.
Yeah, well, God knows if I had the key, I wouldn't be afraid to use it, but he's definitely got a mind of his own. He's a funny horse. He'll he'll chase me out of the stall like nobody's business. But I've got two girls that aren't more than 5 foot, you know, 5 foot tall. He absolutely dotes over them. He loves them. Would do anything in the world for these two little girls. And yet, myself and a couple other guys in the barn, wants nothing to do with us.
Yeah. Well, he's probably pretty smart. Sounds like.
Yeah, that's true.
That's amazing how horses take to certain people and certain grooms it's really something. They do have that bond. Their genome is close to a human genome, so they're very picky about their friends, I guess. But it's not always a bad thing. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here. What's something that we didn't cover that people should know about Matt Chew?
You know, Jude, I think you've done a pretty good job of covering it. I mean, we've gone over obviously the history and racing, the movie stuff, the fact that, you know, we want to eventually work with autistic and, you know, kids with disabilities. I mean, what they should know about me is that, you know, I show up every day early, enjoy what I'm doing. Plan on doing this for a while, you know, as long as I have people that are willing to support me and I'm very thankful to be in this industry. I mean, obviously there's days when I really wished I'd have just, you know, kept with my paper route and or go to flip burgers. There's days that this business will just drive you insane. But, you know, every morning I wake up, I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
And when you're not at the barn, when you're not doing horses, what are some of the things you like to do?
You know what, with the mountains that we have here in the background, I like spending a lot of time up in there. My wife and I go hiking. I spend a lot of time mountain biking up in there. It's a great way to kind of, you know, get away from everything. And, you know, we're only, you know, we actually live at the base of the mountain, so I can literally leave my driveway and be up in the hills in just a few minutes. Love doing that. I like, you know, when we're at Del Mar, I love going into the ocean. Surfing is a pastime. I'm not very good at it, but I sure enjoy the heck out of it. And that's about it. I mean, there's not a whole lot of time for much else. But, you know, those two things keep me occupied when I'm off the racetrack.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because I remember seeing you on a surfboard a few times during Del Mar, and I thought, that's cool, Matt's a surfer. So I used to be a surfer back in the day, but I had a friend that got killed when I was 11 years old. He was surfing, and I gave it up after that. I kind of chickened out, but it's a great sport and very, very relaxing. Well, it's been great, Matt.
Well,
go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, and you did your research. You brought up some things about my family that I didn't even know. So
good.
It's been a lot of fun.
I'm glad we could shed some light on the Chew family, and my invoice will be in the mail.
Okay.
Thanks for being our guest on Trainer Talk, and I wish you the best of luck the rest of the year. Please say hi to your wife, Candace. She's one of the great ladies of racing.
Absolutely, Jude. Thank you.
All right, this is Jude Feld, and on behalf of Matt Chew and our producer, Lee Delapina, in the Lexington, Kentucky studio, we appreciate you listening to Trainer Talk, sponsored by Phasic Tipton. Good night, everyone.